Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings the globe to your ears through original documentary storytelling. Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 20th of April, these are our main stories. A Ramadan charity event in Yemen ends in tragedy with at least 78 people killed in a crash. The United Nations Children's Agency says up to 67 million children have missed routine vaccinations due to COVID lockdowns and disinformation. Michael Schumacher's family plan legal action after a magazine publishes an AI-generated interview of the F1 champion. Also in this podcast, the problem of feral cats in New Zealand.
They're everywhere and they eat birds, eat eggs, all that type of stuff, and they're really hard to catch.
And a controversial proposal to control their numbers. Pictures coming out of the Yemeni capital Sana'a show piles of clothing and shoes strewn about on the steps of a building. They're the only evidence remaining of what was a horrific scene, a panicked crowd that turned into a crush of people in which at least 78 of them died. It happened at a school when people gathered to receive charity money that was being distributed for the holy month of Ramadan. Harry Bly reports.
This is footage from the Yemeni television station Al Mazira, showing a densely packed crowd of people trapped in darkness, the flicker of a few head torches guiding workers who are scrambling to pull those who are still conscious free from the crush, many waving their arms and shouting, desperate to be saved. These people had gathered at a school in the Bab al-Yemen district of the capital Sana'a to receive a cash handout of around $8 to support them during Ramadan. The Houthi authorities, which control the capital, blamed overcrowding for the crush. But eyewitnesses say when the crowd became unmanageable, Houthi forces fired gunshots into the air to try and restore order, striking power lines, which caused an explosion, leading to panic. More footage taken at the school after the crowds had cleared shows the aftermath. Bodies lying on the ground, some injured, others dead. Later, hundreds of shoes, sandals and other scraps of clothing can be seen on the floor, left behind in the chaos. Yemen's Houthi Prime Minister Abdul Aziz bin Habtour called it a great tragedy and said there would be an investigation. More than 300 people were injured at the school. One Houthi security official told the news agency AFP that around 50 were in a critical condition. Three people believed to be the organisers of the charity handout have been arrested.
Harry Bly. COVID jabs have saved many, many lives during the pandemic. But at the same time, the disruption to other immunisation programmes caused by lockdowns led to tens of millions of children missing routine vaccinations. That's according to the UN's Children's Agency, who say the fall in coverage has happened in more than 100 countries. UNICEF's Chief of Global Advocacy, Lily Caprani, said the decreasing uptake had led to more outbreaks of disease.
In the last year, we saw 33 countries reporting major disruptive measles outbreaks. That's up from 22 countries the year before, a doubling of the number of measles cases being reported. These were illnesses that, remember, in the UK, just in 2016, the country was declared measles free, and now it's making a comeback. Other illnesses like polio are making a comeback, and a real reversal of some of the progress we've made with immunisation.
UNICEF is based in Geneva, and our correspondent there, Imogen Folks, told me more about the impact the decline in vaccination is having.
Measles is an illness which has started to kill children again in rich countries because of the lack of confidence. It can also cause very serious heart problems which stay with people for the rest of our lives. Polio, a terrible disease which can cause paralysis. And, you know, apart from the tragedy that that is for the child concerned and their families, that means when these diseases take hold, when polio takes hold, it means people taken out of productive life for the rest of their lives, often. So it's a terrible tragedy for them. It is also a tragedy and a challenge for the people who live with them and the community they live in. And we had, you know, just 15 years ago, we had the goal of polio eradication. And very unfortunately, despite the hard work done from many people here in Geneva, for example, at the World Health Organization, that is slipping back. And one of the reasons is this insidious lack of trust and lack of confidence that has crept in recent years, but particularly during the COVID pandemic.
And Imogen, the WHO are very keen to stress that it is in the best interest of wealthy nations to help poorer nations catch up with these vaccination programs. We heard it so much during the pandemic. No one's safe until we're all safe.
That's absolutely right. I mean, that's why, you know, even if you are, and I sit here in Switzerland and I have friends who have said this to me, well, we don't need it here anymore. We don't have those diseases. Actually, what the WHO will say is it is your public responsibility to have that vaccine, even if you yourself have little chance of catching it. The fewer people vaccinated, the more chance it is that these diseases will come roaring back. They're very infectious. Now, your other point about developed wealthy countries helping poorer ones catch up. Yep, that's another surprise suggestion from another UN agency that funding will be needed. But this is a very, very difficult challenge on all sorts of levels for the UN agencies, because there are just so many challenges, humanitarian crises around the world right now.
Imogen Folks. He was considered one of the world's greatest racing drivers of all time. Michael Schumacher was a seven-time world champion, and it was a major news story when he had a skiing accident in 2013 and suffered severe brain injuries. Little has been heard about Schumacher's condition since then, so it was quite a coup when the German magazine Die Aktuelle published an interview with him. Except it turns out that it wasn't a real interview at all, but an interview with an artificial intelligence version. And now his family say they're going to sue. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
Quite a story, quite a world exclusive, it seemed. I mean, Michael Schumacher hasn't been seen in public since his accident. But yet the latest edition of this weekly German magazine, Aktuell, has a picture of him on the front cover, and it says, "The first interview." Now, there is a clue there that not at all is what it seems. The strapline says, "Es klingt tauschend echt." It sounded deceptively real. But this is a bit like, you know, when you get your insurance policy and you're told to read the small print. An awful lot of people, perhaps most of us, don't. And many people were fooled. They read the interview. They were treated to revelations like, "I was so badly injured, I lay for months in a kind of artificial coma because my body could not have dealt with it." Now, at the end, the article does reveal that this was done by artificial intelligence. You feed into a computer everything you know about someone, what they said, what they did, how they behaved. The computer builds up a profile and artificially generates answers to the questions like this one did. The irony is that there was a real-life interview with Schumacher's wife a few years ago, Karina Schumacher, and they emphasise they did not want any coverage of his condition. "Private is private," she said, and that presumably is why they've now decided to sue.
Paul Moss. Sri Lanka is battling one of the world's most severe economic crises. The economy has slumped by more than a fifth in the last 3 years. And it's become so bad that people are emigrating. It's thought that one in 25 Sri Lankans have left in the last year alone, many of them seeking illegal opportunities abroad. Ed Butler's been hearing from the wife of one economic migrant.
My husband left for Russia 2 months ago. His idea was that he would get work in England.
We're calling this woman Sriani. It's not her real name. She's afraid of speaking publicly about what's happening to her and her family. She and her husband have borrowed heavily to pay for a perilous journey.
The whole trip cost around $10,000. The idea was to head straight to Poland. On March 10th, he called to say they had reached Belarus. He was hungry, he hadn't eaten anything in days, and was cold, he said. There were hundreds of them gathered there. He showed me pictures of lots of migrants in a forest.
Sriani's husband is one of thousands, it seems, travelling right now to Russia on tourist visas. They're hoping to reach the EU on foot, despite the war in Ukraine. We met a visa agent who didn't wish to be identified. A friend is speaking his words.
Some may be going to Belarus. Some others may be trying Sweden or Finland.
How many of these Sri Lankans are real tourists, do you think? What percentage?
In my opinion, it's maybe only 10% real tourists. Others are just seeking migrating to other countries. After Ukraine war started, it has become easier, actually, with the forged documents. Earlier, Russia was very strict on them. They were checking on it. Now they are relaxed.
Officially, more than 300,000 Sri Lankans have left for jobs abroad in the last year. The number going illegally could be twice that, and many of them are falling prey to scammers that appear to be rife in Sri Lanka. To demonstrate the point, a local journalist, Lahiru Dolaswala, is calling one of the dozens of job schemes advertised all over the internet here for an alleged labouring job in Romania.
Hello, mamma mia, kalinu patagara me Romania.
They are asking for 1.3 million rupees.
That's about $3,000, $4,000, right? Yeah. They need up front,
and this excludes the airfare. So this is their commission for finding us a job. They are saying that you can earn around $750 per month. It says your food and your accommodation is provided. It feels too good to be true.
It feels too good to be true. I mean, as far as we're aware, Romania and most European Union countries are really offering virtually nothing in terms of legal employment for Sri Lankans right now.
Yes, that's correct.
So this is almost certainly has to be a scam.
I most probably doubt whether any of these people who go through these interviews would end up in Romania.
But you can see why people are tempted. This crisis has left many Sri Lankans jobless, and the average income of even working households is now just $250 a month.
Venumada me hinawa api kochcherna me hinawa tiyaganna utsaha karanawada.
The government has this month launched an ad campaign highlighting the scams. We must be wary of those who prey on the vulnerable, the narrator warns. But despite the apparent abundance of fraudsters, there's yet to be a single prosecution.
Ed Butler with that report from Sri Lanka, and you can hear more from him on that story in this week's edition of Assignment. One of the most bizarre legal stories of recent years has just concluded in New York. It saw a Russian-born woman sentenced to 21 years in jail for attempting to poison another woman with cheesecake and steal her identity. Our US correspondent Jessica Parker has been following the story.
Victoria Nazarova, who's Russian-born, visited the home of her beautician and friend back in August 2016, and she brought cheesecake. And a slice of that cheesecake was laced with a highly potent sedative, phenazepam. After eating it, the beautician obviously felt very sick. She passed out. And her last memory, we're told, was of seeing Victoria Nazarova walking around her room. The beautician then ended up in hospital. And once she had been discharged from hospital, so she survived all of this, she came home and realised her passport, her employment authorization card were missing, along with some other valuables, including a gold ring. The motive is, supposedly, that she was trying to steal this woman's identity. And Victoria Nazarova, she's sort of been in trouble with the law before. There was an Interpol notice issued for her, this in 2015, for her arrest over the murder of a woman in Russia a year earlier. She'd been accused of killing her neighbour and stealing her life savings. And US media reports Nazarova's a former dominatrix. She's also been accused of drugging and robbing men she'd met on dating websites. But speaking on sentencing, the district attorney, Melinda Katz, described her as a ruthless and calculating con artist.
That was Jessica Parker. Still to come on this podcast.
Oh, just so thrilled and felt so eerie and I had shakes. I just, like, so surprised and just something, like, I'd never experienced before.
We take you to a celestial spectacle in the outback. We'll be right back after this.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
The documentary brings together the best of factual storytelling from across the BBC World Service.
This is a historic opportunity for peace.
To end violence for good in Northern Ireland.
Exploring the world around us and bringing the globe to your ears.
The invasion meant that the lives of millions of Iraqis changed forever.
There are still some memories that I can't talk about.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
An international group of scientists who work with satellite data say the acceleration of the melting of Earth's ice sheets is now unmistakable. The ice loss from Greenland and Antarctica is now responsible for a quarter of all sea level rise. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos told me more.
Important report come out today from a group that calls themselves IMBY. A great exercise of global scientists who have done the intercomparison of satellite measurements going back to the early 90s. Now, since about 92, we've been flying satellites over the poles that have routinely measured the elevation and the velocity of the ice. Those missions, the 50-odd missions, have used slightly different methodologies, and this group of scientists, IMBY, have come together to do the smoothing, to work out the biases and get a reliable figure for the trend over the course of three decades. That's what they've done. And so they've established that in that time, Antarctica and Greenland combined have lost about 7,600 billion tonnes. To put that in context, if you could make an ice cube of that amount, that ice cube would be 20 kilometres high, or 12 miles, which is a big cube. And that just that ice has pushed sea levels up over that period by 21 millimetres.
We know that it's potentially going to speed up in the years to come because of multiple different factors as well, don't
you? You can see that already in the data. So if you go back to the early 90s, the contribution to global sea level rise from melting ice sheets was about 5%. Yeah. Today, it's 25%. In the next 10, 15 years, it's probably going to be 50%.
Jonathan Amos. On Wednesday night, the K-pop star Moonbin was found dead in his apartment in the South Korean capital, Seoul. He was 25 years old. Since 2016, his boy band Astro have gained billions of streams for their music. Well, tributes to Moonbin have flooded in from fans across the world. Music journalist Tema Herman told my colleague James Copnell more about him.
He was a child actor, appeared in very impactful things like TVXQ's music video for Balloons, which was a hit song in 2006. And he played the younger role of one character in the hit 2009 TV show Boys Over Flowers, which was like a huge hit worldwide. And when he and Astro debuted, he was known primarily as a dancer, but generally something that's known in the industry as an all-rounder. He could do everything. He could sing, he could dance, he wrote his songs. And then a few years later, he and another member, Sana, did a spin-off duo, and he was a very popular variety personality and actor. He did it all. His whole career, he was doing everything. Made a lot of people happy and made a lot of great art.
He was only 25
years old. What is known about the circumstances of his death?
Very little is known about the circumstances of his death. There's obviously a lot of rumors. People have bandied about the idea that it's a suicide, but the company has not confirmed that. There's very little known, so they've asked people not to speculate about anything. The story that was reported initially was that, according to the police report, a manager found him dead at home, and that was the end of the story. Previously, the company, Fantasio, had announced that Moonbin and Sana would not be performing at a concert in Jakarta in May. So that news actually, in retrospect, came out before the police report news was reported. So there was obviously some awareness of something going on, but it was unclear at the time how serious the situation was.
And what sort of reaction, what sort of tributes have you been seeing from around the world?
So I'm actually in LA on a quick business trip, and I went to the K-pop store in Koreatown here, and there's a memorial going on, and they're collecting letters and flowers that are going to be sent to the entertainment company in the next week. So fans are, you know, rallying together and finding support in one another on social media. There was a lot of outpouring of love for him. People were sharing their favorite memories. They were sharing why they loved him so much. It was, you know, extremely tragic and sad, but people were really talking about how much they appreciated him and how sad they are that he, you know, has left us.
That's Tamar Herman. A month ago, dozens of Hong Kong's leading human rights activists went on trial under China's controversial national security law. If found guilty, they all face possible life in prison for taking part in what's deemed to have been an unofficial election. Danny Vincent reports from Hong Kong.
In the centre of a busy shopping district on Hong Kong Island rings out a lonely voice of dissent. Since the introduction of the national security law, activists must find creative ways to protest. This two-person demonstration is officially challenging government spending, but a banner stretched across the street booth is blank. Passers-by must read between the lines. Chan Poying is a veteran activist. Her husband, Long Hair, is one of 47 pro-democracy leaders charged with violating the national security law.
In the past, our banners would state our organization and the campaign. A few months ago, the government claimed that we had broken the law.
This group of veteran activists are one of the few opposition political parties left in Hong Kong. Most opposition leaders have been detained or in exile. They're certain they're under surveillance. Tan Kin Shing is a fellow activist, nicknamed The Bull.
There are more than 10 plainclothes police watching me. I can't tell if they are national security police or plainclothes police, but I know they are police officers.
In 2020, Beijing imposed a national security law on Hong Kong following months of protests. Critics say it has weaponized the legal system. Those not detained are afraid to openly campaign for their release.
I've counted more than 10 plainclothes police officers. There isn't any officers wearing uniform here. The officers stand and watch the two-person protest, but they also watch us. Some record with their phones and document anyone that approaches the street booth where the activists are handing out leaflets.
Chan Poying says the national security law has brought about uncertainty.
Surveillance has become more severe for frontline social activists. In the past, the police didn't pay much attention to our street booths. Now, both plainclothes and uniformed police surround us. They even set up cameras and record us. It's psychologically intimidating. You never know when it could be used as evidence.
Don't just blame everything on the national security law.
Tommy Chung is a pro-establishment lawmaker. He says the law has restored stability to the city.
The law is there. Everybody has to obey the law, whether you like it or not. It's passed by the Hong Kong legislatures. So that is a law that we need to uphold. That's a law that we need to abide. And if you break the law, then certain consequences will come into place.
Chan Poying says she's testing the lines.
We are trying our best to widen the space. The red lines up until now are still very vague. For example, the law of inciting subversion. We don't know to what extent we may have already stepped on a red line. So we try our best to speak out until the day they stop us.
Hong Kong is opening up after years of strict COVID restrictions But the space for dissent here is shrinking.
Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. Feral cats are considered a pest in New Zealand, and the authorities are constantly trying to find a way to control their population. The organisers of an annual hunt came up with a novel idea. They urged children to shoot cats this summer, with the child who killed the most being awarded about $150. But after a backlash, the cat hunting competition has now been scrapped. The local journalist, Lloyd Burr, told my colleague Jackie Leonard it had split public opinion.
I mean, I grew up in a rural area. I grew up on a farm. And so it's quite normal for kids that age to, you know, be around guns and having them, using them responsible, whether it's killing pigs or cows and stuff and you know, eating them for meat. It's kind of a normal thing to have shooting competitions around the country, but they've got rid of the entire feral cats segment of the hunting competition.
So is there much surprise at the sort of global horror of the headline? Or is this a very much a rural-urban divide?
I don't think it's... I mean, I've got an uncle who works in one of the parks down in Canterbury, and he's got such a problem with feral cats. He's like, they are just, they're everywhere, and they eat birds, eat eggs, all that type of stuff, and they're really hard to catch. So, yeah, to me, this is quite normal, but I can understand how it's quite a fascinating story around the world.
So the people who are opposed to it, the people who have raised concerns, obviously must also realise that there are risks to birds and so on. What other solutions have been suggested to deal with the feral cat problem?
This is the hard thing, is because it's, you know, it's impossible to differentiate between them. If I've got, you know, my cat Indy's out there catching birds and someone shoots it, because Indy in the wild would look like a feral cat. The word from the Department of Conservation, they're just like, we can't, it's just so hard to control them because you can't have an organised cull, because how do you tell if it is, you know, Indy or if it is a feral cat? And I'm not too sure if trapping works. You know, if you put a little pottle of cat food in there and you catch any cat and then you check to see if it's got a microchip, or do you then put photos of it around the neighbourhood going, is this anyone's cat? If you don't claim it within 30 days, we're going to kill it. What do you do? It's quite a conundrum when you think about it. There's an element of the under 14 hunting competition that I forgot to mention. If the under 14-year-olds brought in any cats that had microchips in it, they'd be disqualified, which was an element that I was just like, well, they're disqualified after the fact because they've killed a domesticated cat. So that element of the competition was a bit ridiculous.
That's Lloyd Burr from Auckland in New Zealand. Now, it is the ultimate celestial spectacle. Thousands of people flocked to a remote Australian town to watch a total solar eclipse. The sky over Exmouth in Western Australia turned dark for about 60 seconds on Thursday when the moon cast a 40-kilometre-wide shadow over the area, totally blocking out the sun. Here's what some of the locals thought.
Oh, just so thrilled and felt so eerie, and I had shakes. I just, like, so surprised and just something like I'd never experienced before.
Oh, incredible. Just incredible. It's my second one. I hope I'm still around for the third one. No, beautiful.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
Definitely.
Someone turned the lights out and turned them back on again. How good was that?
Very excited people there. Well, the total solar eclipse was part of a rare hybrid eclipse, which occurs only a handful of times every century. Amongst the excited spectators in Western Australia was the British astronaut Tim Peake.
The thing that brought it home to me was just how powerful our sun is, because although it's a three-hour eclipse, even when there's just a sliver of sun, it's still light and you can still feel some warmth. But in that kind of four-minute period where it goes from partial to total back to partial, the temperature drops so dramatically, the light levels drop, and yet you can look out on the horizon and you can see daylight out there, but just not where you're stood in the shadow. It really kind of connects you back to nature, back to the stars, back to the planets, reminds you of how it all works and the fact that we are just on a small planet orbiting an average star in the solar system. Even nature gets very confused. All the birds I was watching, they just went to roost. Everything went very, very quiet and eerie for those few seconds.
That was the British astronaut Tim Peake who witnessed that rare spectacle. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thirsty and the producer was Rebecca Wood. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
With DoorDash, you can now get even more delivered to your door. Groceries, self-care, restaurants, and snacks. With $0 delivery fees on your first order. Get more from your neighborhood delivered with DoorDash. Terms apply. Visit DoorDash.com.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.